Good morning, good afternoon, good day, good midday. It's nice to see you again. Thank you so much for showing up. I can't tell you how grateful I am to have you here to listen to my contemplations, my thoughts, my conundrums, and hopefully we can help inspire each other to be curious and to go help other people be curious as well. It's been an interesting week. I've been off work. My son's teacher at the daycare ended up getting a positive COVID test, so we haven't been allowed to go back, and which is cool. It's all safe. We're not showing symptoms, so it's okay. But just had a lot more free time, not working and all that. Hoping I'm getting that extra pay. Really, really hoping that'd be really handy at this point. But either way, one of the things that I decided to do was to go get us some art supplies. Odin's been doing a bunch more art recently. I try not to let him have too much TV. It's one of those things that just sickens me. Like I he's watching TV right now, but he has a limited supply of TV that he's allowed to have. And this is mainly because I need my space in here until it's his turn for everybody's favorite segment, Ask O. At least it's my favorite. But TV for me, it just I never wanted to lean on it as the backup parent. It's not a backup parent, and I don't see any reason why I should rely on it and for him to have any hooks, you know, because it's like, it's so weird with the kids. Like it's the first thing he talks about when I pick him up from school. It's the first thing he thinks about when he messes up. It's the only tool I have to take away from him as a threat. It's the only thing he really cares about. And that's dangerous, and it's more than concerning as a parent, you know? So I've been trying to be a little bit heavier handed when it comes to allowing him TV time, and I want to get down to 30 minutes a day, you know, 30 minutes to an hour a day. And if he has, it already is this way when he has mistakes and he messes up behavioral wise at school, I already take it away. That's the first thing that goes as soon as he has any issues. And he knows, you know, it's one of the first things we talk about, which is sad. You know, it's the first thing I have to say is like a tool, like, dude, am I going to take TV away? You know, like, but so he's been getting more into art stuff, you know, just drawing, you know, and I really enjoy his art. Watching him make things and how proud he is of those things is just, it's really nice to see. It feels good. And so I got some pastels and some brush tip markers, which are kind of like painting tip markers. Like they're like almost like paint brushes. I got a box of colored pencils. I got, some charcoal sticks, and I want to get more, you know, but, and so I'm trying to make sure we take really good care of all this stuff, which has been sort of a struggle. But it's been really fun sitting with him. And now we have this brand new thing that we could do together where we can create and I can watch him create, and it is nice. So that's what I've been doing a lot of this week, is doing a lot of art myself. And I've never considered myself a very creative person. So it's been really good stepping outside of my comfort zone, so that I can try to do these things. And you know what? I'm not half bad. I'm not the worst artist. I wouldn't say that I'm especially gifted by a long shot, but it feels good. It's, you know, that's just what I've been focusing on, is like, you know, what are the good habits in my life that I could propagate and try to nurture, you know, because there's things that everything takes time, everything takes work, but there are things that you could do that are wholesome. And, you know, sitting down with the kiddo and making things is just wholesome, you know? And like yesterday, I took him to the park and I just took the bucket of art supplies and, you know, I just sat in the grass and I drew for an hour, and I marked up this tree that was in the park vicinity, And, you know, there's a table underneath it, you know, one of those aluminum, the really light aluminum picnic tables, you know, I'm sure you can envision one. And the tree's leaves are just these yellows and these greens and these light greens. And, you know, I lost myself trying to duplicate it. And it's all right. You know, it's not like, but it'll always be special to me, you know, and I'm going to keep that. And every time I look at that, I'll remember that day. You know, it's anchor points that can be set up as well. But either way, anyways, I digress. Enough of my business. You know, let's get into today's show. So my first question to you is, how do you make a decision? Now, consider it in all the different aspects of what a decision is and what decision making is. You know, it's a heavy thing. And I would hazard to say that we almost have this tank within us that is like decision-making juice, you know, decision-making gas. And making decisions reduces our mental or physical or whatever energy just to make those decisions. It costs that, you know, and not all decisions are the same. There's big and there's small decisions. There's good and there's bad decisions, you know, and heavy decisions are going to cost a lot more energy to make. So how do we make these things? Like, what is a decision? You know, do I want apple juice or do I want orange juice? Am I going to go to sleep right now or am I going to stay up and watch this TV show? Am I going to get in my room and record, or am I just going to sit there and watch TV and eat junk food? You know, because I've been doing a lot of that this week. You know, is it always two choices, or could you have three or four or five choices? Like, when you're looking for apartments, how much choice do you have? You know, and of course I'm pulling up personal things here for me, you know, but when you're looking for a new job, you know, you might have a myriad of options. So it's not like it's always simple. It would be a lot easier if there was always just two things, you know? So, good and bad decisions. What is a good decision and what is a bad decision? If we can make these things, if we can take the time and the energy to choose, you know, who's to say what's good or bad? How do we judge these situations to be good or bad? You know, I would say a good decision is always going to work out. It's going to pay off. Doesn't seem to hurt anyone. You know, and a bad decision, you know, is going to be the opposite to that. Doesn't seem to work. It hurts somebody or hurts you. You know? Do you always know if a decision is good or bad when you make it? I mean, I guess sometimes. I mean, a lot of the times we have enough premeditation to know. But often, the knowledge that this was a good or a bad decision is purely in hindsight. And that's Captain Hindsight's terrain. And when we are playing Captain Hindsight, until we have a time machine to go back in time, it is one of the most useless capabilities and powers to have, unless we use it for the future. But if we are caught in the trap of never knowing if our decisions are good or bad, you know, or not spending the time to cast that decision in a good or a bad light, and that might take some sort of moral code to be built, if not by you, at least by looking around and looking for good models of behavior, you know, not to lose myself. But I'm not always sure if my decisions are good or bad. And that's part of the torture of making a decision, especially when you have to make a decision beforehand and you're not allowed to cast it yet, but you kind of carry that decision around with you. I don't know if that makes any sense. Like, say, you know, you got a temporary job. You got a month of job up. So you have a month to figure out where your new job is going to be. And in that time, you have certain things that you could do. You could search for jobs. You could go to interviews. You could move your body around, go talk to people, take suggestions, ask questions. You know, let's say 2 weeks into that moment, you've made your decision. You maybe got a job, you know, and there's 2 weeks of time left. But say in that waiting period between the old moment and the new moment, you have all of this space where you could be exposed to new other opportunities. And that could lead you to not feel that your initial decision was a good decision. I don't know if that makes any sense. So say you've chosen this job, you went to the interview, said, okay, I accept it. A weekend, you got a week left, and then all of a sudden somebody else comes by and offers you double that amount of money, but you've already accepted a new job. You know, all of a sudden the tables have turned. All of the evidence that you're holding to make these decisions has changed. And all of a sudden the decision that you had went from being good to bad. That's one example of it, but there's all kinds of shades of gray, you know, like, when you choose to marry somebody for the rest of your life, you know, that's another big gap of space that you really can't tell how you're going to change, how she or he is going to change, you know, and maybe 10 years down the road, you meet somebody spectacular, you know, not to be that person, you know, but like, I'm not involved with anybody, so I don't have a lot of votes to cast here, so nobody be mad at me, but you know, it's just, there's always incoming new data all the time. And that can severely change how you're feeling and how you'd make a decision. And often after you've made that decision is when new information comes. And that can be tragic, and that can make it just so much more difficult. I guess is the point of what I'm getting at here. You know? When we're not planning, and we're really not considering our actions, if we're in a very ignorant mindset, we're definitely not going to realize whether the decision was good or bad. And often when we're in that mindset, we're just purely acting without thinking, or we're reacting, or say we're in a survival mindset, you know, and if you're struggling really hard, you don't have time to think about all those pleasant little considerations that you don't have time for. So sometimes we know if the decision is good or bad. And a good decision that's made, we knew it way beforehand. We were positive this was going to be a good idea. Those are the best decisions to make. Or at least to foe ourselves into that headspace to at least believe that we're doing it right. And that maybe that takes confidence, you know? So, what are some examples that we can think of good or bad decisions? You know, and I know a lot of these are going to be redundant. A lot of these are going to be habits and things that I talk about all the time. But still, I think they're important, even if it is redundant. Repetition requires response, hopefully. So, early morning wake-ups, you know, getting up with the alarm clock, going to the gym like we're supposed to, eating a good breakfast like we know we're supposed to, even if we're not hungry, getting down and meditating if we don't feel like it. I've been really bad about meditating on my weekends and my days off. And, you know, I've noticed it really bad not having time, not having a lot of structured things that I needed to go to this week. My other habits were falling out. And because I had less to do, I was doing even less, which makes absolutely no sense to me. If I have less going on, shouldn't I be filling up that space with constructive activities? Why do, when I have less going on, do I do less? I get even lazier. I do less and less. Like, it makes me sick. You know, I do better when I'm busy, unfortunately. You know, like when I have a structured routine and I have a job to go to and I have 40 hours a week, you know, I do better with those routines, and it keeps me meditating on a good schedule. It keeps me doing my things on a good schedule, which is such a weird I can't get my head on that because I get so excited every time. I'm like, I have all this free time coming up. I'm going to use this time so well. And it just, it doesn't work that way, fellas and gals, friends and family, you know. But anyways, you know, so early morning, that's a really good opportunity to make good decisions, and we can practice, and those are small decisions. You know, sneak attack appointments that come up out of nowhere, and that could be medical or, like, say, friendship, you know, friendship appointments. Like, hey, man, I need help moving. Well, of course, you know, like, I was going to go do something else with this time, but this is a great opportunity to go be altruistic and go help somebody I care about, or maybe somebody I don't even know that well. That's even better. Go help a stranger. You know, that stuff grows us. It puts water on the seed that's inside of us, that loving seed, that power, you know? And so these sneak attack appointments are great opportunities to make good decisions, you know, and medical stuff happens to me all the time because I'll forget about it. So I'll get these calls midweek. We're like, hey, you got an appointment tomorrow. And I'm like, ugh. I'm like, okay, I'm going to go do this. You know, that's a great opportunity to not reschedule and be like, okay, this is a little bit inconvenient, but I can go do this. I can go take this. I can go take care of this, you know? So the theme of a lot of these are things that we don't want to do that we do anyways, you know, choosing grace over anger. You know, every single time we get into an altercation with somebody, even a minor disagreement or a flagrant violent encounter, all these situations are split second situations. And there's always that half second or second where your inner being goes, okay, how am I going to handle this? Am I going to duke this person out in the face? Or am I going to try to be graceful and understand them? And as soon as we make that decision one way or another, it's like a separate path that we start walking, and it's really hard to backtrack. So it's a great time. Every time somebody slightly pisses you off, choose grace. You know, these are, that feels like it's one of the best decisions that I could make, is to always treat people gracefully, you know. And I need to do it more with my son, you know, because it's a million times a day where the kid comes up and says some annoying or just don't have time for it. You know, I know every parent relates, but those are great times to choose grace and be like, okay, I'm going to be a good parent right now. I'm going to be loving and I'm going to take care of this. You know, doing what needs to be done in the moment, which often means fixing mistakes. You know, I think of my work often. And food is one of those things, you know. I know every person has been outside or indoors and dropped a piece of food on the ground, picked it up real quick, brushed it off. Yeah, 5-second rule. It's okay. You know, eat it. And that's absolutely not allowed when you're in the industry, when you're cooking for other people, when you're doing heavy cooking for thousands and thousands of people that you see in a week. You can't afford to drop stuff on the ground and contaminate everybody else's, because that's how you get foodborne outbreaks. That's how you can hurt a lot of people that way. And so one of the most hilarious and awful stories that I can remember about this situation is one of the first jobs I ever had. Not one of the first jobs I ever had. I was just younger. My son was very small. I had just moved up to Greeley, which is up in northern Colorado. And right off the highway, there is a Cracker Barrel there. And I was dishing there. I was a dishwasher because I hadn't had a line cook position. I couldn't get on the cooking line because I didn't have enough experience to do it at this point. And so I was washing dishes. And I remember at the end of the nights, we would get these huge, like, they looked like refrigerators with lots of racks on them, but they were hot refrigerators. They were called hot boxes. And they'd be kept like 180 degrees, and there would just be food on each tray, and then it would keep them hot. So you'd make a shit ton of mac and cheese that you could hold for like 4 or 6 hours. And so you could put it in there and keep it and then pull it out, and it'd be the same temperature. You could just go to serving. Necessary items for this style of cooking. And so around 9:50 every night, we would get all the shit back on these hot boxes, and I would toss them, and oftentimes I'd eat off of them if I was broke and didn't have any food, you know. And so I remember I tossed all these potatoes, and I guess 5 minutes before close, some dude came in and asked for potatoes, like baked potatoes, you know. And so I had just tossed the pan 2 or 3 minutes before, and so these are like a 30-minute cook time item. So just looked over at the cook and I was like, sorry, man, just tossed it. And I picked it up out of the trash can, I took my dish hose and I sprayed off the potato that was covered in filth from the trash can. And this dude came over off the line, grabbed it out of my hand, cut it, put it in the microwave, nuked it, served it. And it came back 10-15 minutes later with like half eaten, like somebody had eaten it. And I remember laughing my ass off at the time because I was a dumb kid and that shit was just, it just seemed hilarious. And there's a funny aspect to it. But right now saying it, I don't feel good about myself. It wasn't like it was like this experience. It wasn't. It was an awful, awful moment. And it was a bad moment, you know? And so, yeah. So not a good moment. So like, fixing things in the moment. If I had been a real person back then, I would have gone to talk to the server, said, hey, we don't have any, we got to do something different. You know, so when you drop food, when you're working, you can't just serve it, you know, like big spills. One time I was working at Walmart and it's really easy to drop some, just walk away. You know, that happens a lot of the time. Like I've dropped stuff at the grocery store and just straight walked away or just dropped it in a different location because I didn't need it anymore. So I just put it on a shelf where it doesn't belong. How shady. You know, so I remember I was working at a Walmart one time and I spilled a whole half gallon of oil and there was like this oil spill. It was like 6-7 feet in diameter. And, you know, I remember thinking that moment, I can just walk the fuck away. It didn't happen, you know, but to make a good decision is to take care of that moment, doing what needs to be done in the moment, fixing the mistake in the moment, you know. Another food service is people breaking down boxes, man. Like, especially front of house people often think it's not their job to break down boxes, so they don't, you know, or helping other people with dishes when the dishwasher is not there, bussing tables, right? You know, helping like one of the worst things for a back of house dishwasher is to get plates of food still on them, you know, scraping off some shit, you know, like there's never not enough time to help your fellow team member out, especially if you're in a kitchen, you know? And so, yeah, all of my examples here have been from my past, and I'm a cook, and a lot of my mistakes were made when I was younger, so I wasn't in very good kitchens at this time. So these are a lot of the stories that I have to tell, you know, like, but we always have an opportunity to make a good decision. There's always the opportunity to at least, maybe sometimes there's no opportunity. Maybe there are decisions that have to be made that nobody wins and are just bitter to make, but often, very often, guys, very, very often, you know, there's a split second where we can make that choice to do the right thing and to feel good about what we chose to do. Bad decisions. Yet again, one of the biggest things that I can think of when we make bad decisions seems to come from a place of ignorance. And in my past, you know, I lived as an addict for a large section of my life. And thinking back to being an active addict, it is just a daily run of bad decisions, you know? And at the end of the night, I'd have these talks with myself where I'd be like, tomorrow's going to be different. I know what I needed to do. And oftentimes I knew exactly what I needed to do. And I'd wake up feeling like shit. And that's the first bad decision, which is why often nowadays I start my days out with good decisions. I start out by meditating immediately. You know, and that's purposeful, you know, because as an addict, one of the first things you do is you take it, whatever that it is, you know, when you see somebody drinking as soon as they wake up in the morning, that's scary. You know, beer is not coffee, you know, let alone hard liquor, you know, and part of being an addict is prioritizing fun over responsibility. And you can do this even when you're not an active addict. Like being in recovery, this is one of the things I've noticed in myself, is that even without my substance, I still prioritize things that don't need to be over things that I should have been more involved in. As a parent, prioritizing my son over myself always, you know, like that needs to be the most important thing, is our dependents, our responsibles. As soon as we start putting TV over sleep, as soon as we start putting alcohol over sleep, you know, like as soon as we start gutting the time that we have to work on ourselves, work on personal time, work on bettering our situations, maneuvering so that our families and we are safer and healthier. And instead of using that time for that, we use it fucking off or just sitting around doing nothing, you know? And I'm talking about myself here. I'm not pointing fingers. This is all personal, you know, like, but it just, it happens too often in my day. And it's these series of thousands of decisions we have every day that are very tiny decisions, you know, and a lot of those little bad decisions, they add up into big snowballs. Picking fights, man, you know, like road rage. You know, kind of a silly story. One of the things that I used to do when I was a kid is like, I would never be the angry driver. Now I kind of feel it now because I got angrier as an adult. Like when I was younger, I remember getting people pissed off at us and just following them, you know, just following them. And they'd start taking U-turns and like trying to get away from you because it's real sketchy when you notice somebody following you in a car. And it's not like you can speed away very dangerously, but you can't do that in a big city. So it turns out it's like this really mediocre cat and mouse chase game, you know, and like we'd follow people in a neighborhood sometimes. That's really sketchy. You know, what if somebody had a firearm, you know, like somebody could have shot us if they got scared enough, you know, like, but this was tied to this culture of aggression and violence that we have even around cars right now. Like, how silly is it to be driving these 2-ton machines that are these metal dragons that have fiery pistons that are just insanely powerful that could kill anybody? Like, even if you plowed into another person's car, you could decimate their 2-ton metal beast because they're going so fucking fast. And we're going to get mad and angry on top of that and try to put more people in danger by driving erratically or possibly hurting them. What if you actually killed the person you were mad at? What if you actually ended up killing the person that you were so pissed off of that you were thinking about killing them in your head? What if they actually died and you had to go through all that manslaughter shit, go to court, or so help you not manslaughter, or somebody actually gives you homicide for reckless endangerment driving? I don't know the actual logistics of this shit, but it's one of the silliest fucking things I can think of is road rage, you know? And it's easy because it's this outlet where you don't have an open line of communication. They're in their own little bubble. You can yell and scream or you can honk your horn, but not a lot of people give a shit anymore, you know? And so I see that as this horrendously heavy bad decision that we can make when we get behind a car, when we're commuting with hundreds of other people, when we decide to drive stupid. So please don't drive stupid, folks. Do it for me. Do it for the gingerbread man. Please don't drive stupid. Drive smart. Drive with good decisions. yeah. Oh, man. So, yeah. So good versus bad. Good versus bad. So there's a dichotomy. Maybe some decisions, if we can pull up the gray, the shades of gray, the scales, the magical gingerbread scales, one of my favorite tools. Maybe things aren't always good or bad. Maybe it's hard to peg it as good or bad. Maybe there are some very shady decisions that have to be made. You know, speaking, we just talked about dangerous driving, but if you have somebody who's dying in your car, you're probably going to drive very fast. Or if your child is being born at that time period, you're probably going to drive like a hooligan, you know, like, if somebody's endangering somebody who you care about, you'll probably hurt or maim them, you know, and it probably wouldn't matter what other shit happened, any legal issues, depending on how important that situation is and how the person, you know, dependent value, wherever you want to put that, you know? So, yes, I hesitate to say there are only good and bad. There are shades here, and we can never forget the scales, because nothing is ever absolute, ever. So what stops us from making decisions? What makes it difficult? I know we already brought up some things, such as, I can't even remember what we were talking about. Doesn't matter. But one of the things that can make it harder is the weight of old decisions. And that could be either way. You know, if you've had a lot of good decisions that you made, I feel like a lot of people are insanely lucky. When I look up at rich people, a lot of that sure is hard work, but a lot of that just feels like fucking luck to me, you know? And that's cool and all, but if you have a lot of good decisions behind you, that has to build up that confidence thing that we've mentioned a couple times now. And confidence, which I looked up the definition for, according to dictionary.com, is the feeling or belief that one can rely on something, you know? Confidence is built. And if you're lucky, you could have confidence by luck, not just by hard work. And there's different types of confidence. We can have confidence in ourselves. We can have confidence in the group. We can have confidence in ideas. You know, to feel that a country matters and that Americans or whatever country you have, I'm speaking from person, I live in the US of A, you know, there's many patriotic people out there that are very nationalistic in the American tribe. You know, there's a confidence in that idea to even feel that way. And I don't have any confidence in the system of countries to even feel that patriotic about it. You know, sorry to lose you if you're a very patriotic American, but I'm not. And it's because I don't have a lot of confidence in that idea. There's not a good track record of decisions where it's shown to be real or effective to me. So the weights of these things that have happened of the past, it layers up and it paints on things. So when I was fresh out of high school, I interned at a film studio for a couple weeks, and I was in the tape room. So I got to look at a whole bunch of old film reels, and they had an infinity wall there. And an infinity wall is a wall with curves on the edges so that you can't see the corners, and you can paint it one color and you can't tell where the fucking wall is. You'll walk right into it, you know? And so I remember I had to clean off and chip off a segment of this wall one time, and you had 30, 40 years of paint stripes, and it looked like an old Gobstopper gumball with just layers and layers of colors, hundreds of layers. And it was gorgeous. And that is the metaphor for me for how events affect us and weigh on us. And even our old choices layer and weigh and color the way that we perceive what's happening right now. So if we've had a bad track record, that can paralyze us. You know, like, oh God, every choice that I've made has fucked me. Which is one of those things that I catch myself in, is this self-blame and this pity. Where I'm just like, oh God, you know, that fucked me. I didn't do good there. And so all of a sudden you fall into this hole of depression where you're paralyzed by this, just like this contempt, you know? And it comes down to that confidence, the confidence in our competence and how competent we believe we are. When every single person out there is completely competent, you are competent. You have the ability to do whatever you need to do. When you put your foot down, you can make your dreams happen. No matter how many trials and tribulations, it might not be easy. It might hurt doing it, but you can get whatever you work for, whatever you put your mind to. You know, I do think that we are that strong and we have that capacity as humans. But always consider that when you're making a decision, if you feel bad or gross or anxious about a decision, maybe sit down and just consider for a second, like, hey, what's my track record? What has the last couple weeks been like? What's the last couple months been like? How do I feel about my place and my choices that I've made over the past couple years? Strongly consider how your track record might be coloring your feelings about yourself, and that might be making the decision harder. Speaking of being paralyzed, we can be paralyzed by a history of unfortunate shit. We can also be paralyzed by something that's outside of ourselves. And I call this the paralysis of choice. You know, one of the things they tell us with our kids to reduce anxiety and to help them become more independent is to reduce choice. And so we're supposed to, I know I mentioned this, but give them two options, two simple options every time. Have them practice making that decision, but always make it two, never more than two, because it's less confusing. And that's true for adults too. But we often have more than two choices to choose from. And often we have this artificial variety of choices, you know, that's not even practical because of the system and the institutions that we interact with, like TV. one of my least favorite things to do is trying to find a TV show and I don't know what I'm wanting to watch. Especially nowadays, you just have a trillion quadrillion options. And just sitting there scrolling, like just scrolling for hours, like it makes me feel awful. And especially when you have other people with you and you have to make the decision for others, because all of a sudden you'll find some, oh no, I don't want that. Or, oh yeah, I want that. And you don't feel like it's just, it's such a conflicting, weird thing. And it'd be so much easier if it was back in the day when there might've only been three or four channels. I wonder if they had the same disputes over it between three channels versus 400 channels, you know? So having too many things can really make it difficult. And I think a lot of us are under this illusion that, like, one, we take it for granted because a lot of the kids nowadays, and I know I'm not that old, but there's a lot of people who are younger than me that grew up in this. And I remember not having a quadrillion channels, you know, I remember having rabbit ears and radio and, you know, like fucking, but a lot, especially the younger ones I worry about, don't realize that it might be artificial having all these extra options. They take it for granted and then they feel lucky. You know, like, oh yes, maybe I'll have more options in the future, because there's this absolute lack of acknowledgement that these choices are difficult and they cost energy. That tank that we talked about at the beginning of the episode, you know, if you have to make 100 extra artificial choices that you didn't have to make being a human 100 years ago, your tank is going to be depleted that much faster. And maybe you have much bigger choices to make in this artificial environment too. You know, you might have to make more bigger financial choices all the time that are just draining and awful. And you're also on top of that, choosing from a billion TV shows, you know, or a billion food places or what have you, like insert here, you know, like, so I would almost argue for restricting myself and considering the restriction of too many choices and options, you know, at least making it simpler for yourself, having planned out, this is what I'm going to do here and here and here, so I don't have to make the decision. You know, one of the things, planning meals, it's one of the most draining choices for me when I get home at the end of my day, when I've woken up at 4:30 in the morning and I've worked my ass off and I'm coming home to be full-time dad and I have to choose what to make for dinner. It makes me nauseous. It's one of my least favorite choices. And just having that choice made out in the future, simply having simple meal options, simple choices. And so when I get home, I don't have to make that choice. I just have to follow through with the plan. I can keep some of my energy and I don't have to burn that gas, and I could use it for other things. And I often feel better. At least I feel a little less beat. Another thing that I see that comes up with choices often is this flip-flop, this flipping and back and forth between choices. So often it'll be more than just one choice, you know? We might be flipping back and forth between two good options, and then, like, I'll find myself with, like, complete conviction, like, this is what I'm going to do. And then a couple hours later, I'm like, wait, I think I'm going to do that other thing, you know? And so I end up flipping back and forth, and then I don't want either of them because I can't figure out which one's the better choice. So instead, I demonize them both. I don't know if you do this, but that's awful too. So I would also advocate for once making a decision, sustaining that confidence, training that confidence in ourselves, so that we can commit to a decision when we made it, when we have a good radar on whether it feels good or bad, we've planned it out and we can sustain ourselves on that decision. If we can stay committed to one without flipping flopping, we don't have to make as many different choices. We don't have to press the gas pedal as many times. Part of what makes this flipping flopping happen, flipping flopping, I know that's just such a graceful term. I feel like we have these mental models, like these projections of what's happening in our lives and inside our minds, you know? And when we run through a choice, it's almost like we have like a, what do they call those things? A simulator that we're running, like this is what could happen. If I put A in, I might get B back. You know, I'm gonna plug this in and see what comes out of the other end. And often these mental models and projections aren't accurate either. So the more time we play in these playgrounds that don't really exist in reality beyond our own head, you know, like, the easier it is to flip-flop, the easier it is to get confused and to lose our conviction. So maybe not playing in those playgrounds once a choice is made, and not continuing to sandpaper your skull, like, just keep rubbing on it. Because not only is that more tiring, not only is it continual pressure on your choice tank, you know, like, day's just too short. Make a decision and run with it. And maybe focus on something else because you have other decisions to make. One of the biggest things that I flip-flop on in my life is substituting meals. I have a lot of kids with allergies, and I'll have to substitute, like, you know, milk's easy because they get a milk alternative. But say I have gluten-free kids, you know, I have a limited amount of things that I could sub for a gluten-free kid, but I could also give them something completely different, like turkey. You know, so it's just like, and I always forget about it. So I never make the choice ahead of time. And it's always when I've put food out in the last 15 minutes before service that I'm scrambling to get my substitutions together. And I'll get confused because making those little choices when I'm already tired, I know it sounds really silly, but it can really fuck me up. And it can really stress me out, man. Like, and so having a good substitute always, like, knowing what I'm subbing for in my head, it's like, oh, it's this, I can sub for this. No choice needs to be made because it's already, this is in stone. This is what we do, you know? So it's not a choice. It's just done. It's doing without doing, as the Taoists would say. Not a do through not a do, action through non-action, maybe. And this is, it's kind of tied to, like, I don't know, this is the complete opposite kind of feeling, but it's loosely tied. Do you ever, like, leave the house and you, like, feel like you left the lights on or not? And, like, when you left the house, you had no issue thinking the lights were on, but all of a sudden this idea intruded into your consciousness where all of a sudden there's a reality where, oh, maybe the lights are on. And I could, like, see it in my head. I'll have, like, a mental picture of a light on in my room, and I'll get down there, lights off, because the mental projection was false. Mental projection wasn't real, you know? And I'll do it with the oven at work. I'll do it with burners. You know, whenever I leave something, the worst possibility is always an option. And then I will flip-flop what I should do based upon this mental projection of what's non-existent. But often it has saved my ass, because there's always going to be those times when you did leave the lights on or the burner. Oh, geez. You know, like, I take dabs, you know, and often, like, I'll leave the torch on a little bit, and that scares the shit out of me. Never, ever have I ever left a torch on in the house. But, like, you know, you'll look over and there'll be, like, a little baby pilot light because you didn't turn it off all the way. That shit's scary. You know, so there is a place and there is a point for this flip-flop, you know, but just be mindful of it. And when you're working and there's nothing you can do about making a choice because you physically can't leave where you're at, you're doing something right now, your time and energy needs to be in the here and now, right now. You know, those are the time periods when you need to consider the what's going on and where your energy needs to be, you know, not to lecture you. So, you ever heard the term, don't make mountains out of molehills? It's one I remember a lot. I got told it so many times as a child. So many times that it's one of those things that just pissed me off. I remember being in a therapy session when I was probably middle school or high school and hearing a therapist bring that up. And I just remember I was just like, oh, it's fucking bullshit. Because I had it used against me, or at least considered it as some sort of verbal fodder used against me, that I didn't even want to hear it. But it goes back and forth either ways. We can make mountains into molehills. We can make molehills into mountains. And it's all based on how big or small a decision is. You know, and say we have a really small decision, but we have a bad track record, so we're super anxious about it. And so all of a sudden, the small decision turns into a big decision, and we don't make it because of our feelings of anxiety. That's not effective. I've done it, you know? But we can also make a mountain into a molehill. We can have something that's really, really important. Like, I've seen people give up their kids. Really, really, really important. And we don't give it the time that it needed. And that's scary too. And how confident can we be in our decisions that they're good or bad if we didn't even know how big or small the problem was, and we hadn't categorized it and we hadn't put it in the right box yet? You know? That worries me when I look at my own decision making and I look at my own track records. What are some big decisions? You know, a lot of big decisions tied to finances, but a lot of them are tied to feelings and emotions too. You know, purchases are big decisions, and that could be cars or homes. You know, a car costs a shit ton of money. I'm on car payments right now because I had to finance it. They cost so much money, it's a decision that adds new burdens and new bills onto your life for years or months beyond. That's a decision that's heavy to make. Fucking exhausted me. And this is one of those situations where I turned a mountain into a molehill and I let somebody make the decision for me almost. You know, and if I'd stuck to my guns, I wouldn't have financed a car and I'd be in a slightly different situation now, you know? So that's why, to backtrack, that's why it's always important to be able to categorize our decisions well, to know how big it is and how small it is. You know, homes, somewhere you're going to live for a really fucking long time. Depending on the market, you can make money on a home too. It can be an investment, you know, like relationships, huge, huge, huge. Marriage, cohabitation. If you bring another child into this world, you are tied to that co-parent, whether or not you're with them for the rest of your life. You know, and my son's mother is barely part of his life right now, but she is still a major part of my subconscious and my conscious mind because my son's here and he's part of her and I can see her face in him and I'm constantly aware of how he needs her. You know, like, so even the absence of the co-parent is still a huge presence in your life. That's a huge decision to make, to bring a child into this world. You know, it's a big decision just to live with somebody else because you don't know how that's going to affect the relationship in the first place. Living with anybody, I would be wary of living with my best friends, and I currently live with my best friends and I'm so lucky that I have them, but I'm not sure that I could live with anybody else, even anybody else that I'm very friendly with. I'm pretty sure that there's aspects of living with somebody that deteriorates that relationship. And we don't even think about it because we've molehilled it. We don't weigh it the way it should be. You know, marriage is heavy, 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 heavy. You know, and I'm very happy for people who make that decision from a good place. You know, but I've seen a lot of people hurt by this institution, by the legal aspects of it that turn into financial very quickly. Employment. Huge jobs, moving up in a job, taking a promotion, moving down in a job, moving sideways, picking a new job, choosing a new career altogether. How terrifying is that? Moving your physical location, whether you're moving houses, I know we just talked about houses, but you can also move borders. You can move into a new state, into a new physical place where you don't know anybody anymore. A lot of people do it, but that's a big ass decision. How do you plan your future? You know, do you make decisions for training, for going to get extra training for your job, for getting extra certifications, going to higher education, paying the financial dues to go to college or school to hopefully better your situation that it will be financial again in the future because you could get a better job because of your education? You know, how about the decisions we make every day for our health, whether it's not to touch that substance we're addicted to, whether to eat well? You know, it's a choice to eat something we don't necessarily want to eat. It's a choice to go to sleep on time, even though we want to stay up and watch that or drink that or read that or draw that or insert here, whatever the fuck. You know, sleep is one of the most important things for us because it's what rejuvenates us, you know. Priorities. I want to do another definition. Commitment. Definition, dictionary.com says, a pledge or a promise to do something. An obligation can also have a negative connotation, such as, oh, I have commitments. I think that's good enough. You know, I think the word could be deeper. It's a commitment to ourself. Commitment is standing by what we decide we're going to do with the flipping flopping, knowing the right path for us. You know? How committed are you? How committed are you to you? How committed are you to your life? How committed are you to your family? How committed are you to your love? How committed are you to your health and your safety? Are you safe with yourself right now? Are you treating yourself with the respect it needs to thrive and to give other people respect and peace? I can tell you right now that I, the gingerbread man, am 100% committed to you. And I'm not going anywhere. This show will be here every week until I die. You will have my words in your ear trying to be helpful, or at least expressing myself so that I can try to relate in a helpful way. And I'd really like you to be part of the process. My personal email address is Brandon, Brandon, WVOGT @gmail.com. I'd really appreciate it to have a conversation. You know, I want to be a friend to you. I want to be a confidant. I want you to be able to be part of the creative process of this show. If you have any ideas for what we could talk about in the future, if you have any gripes or disputes with anything that I've said in this episode or a past episode, which I want to encourage everybody to get backtrack a little bit. I have a lot of material. I have a lot of things that I've talked about, and I hope there's a lot of stuff there that I hope could be helpful, not just this week's episode. So I encourage you to backtrack a little bit. But if you find anything, any addition, you know, I will bring up any information you have and I'll put it on the show and we can all discuss it. You know, this is a community project and you are important and I'm committed to you. And I'm also confident that you can build your confidence. So one of the things that makes decisions easier to make is having good habits in life. And habit formation is a funny thing, because I know we've all felt it, and it can happen quickly or it can happen really slowly. It can take a lot of work, it can take a lot of effort, or it can just take half a second. So according to Healthline, which is an okay website, and the ucl.uc.uk, which seemed to be some sort of educational website, I think, from the UK, I don't know. Both of them said that it takes roughly 66 days for a strong habit to form. Or at least an automatic habit where you don't have to think about it anymore. But the common myth and belief, which I found on multiple websites, including Psychology Today's, was that it takes about 21 days. But on this one article I read, which I found hilarious, is like, do you really expect it to take 21 days for you to get addicted to crack? So depending on how pleasurable an event or a choice or an outcome could be influences how likely we are to do it. And this can impede or it can lubricate habit formation in the moment. So if something very pleasurable like crack or heroin or McDonald's, it can be really easy to start doing those things very quickly and often because they feel good. And as a coping mechanism, we try to make ourselves feel better. So, what's the root of that? Just be mindful. If it feels really good, be wary. If it's really hard, but you know it's a good thing, know it's going to take time. Sometimes a reward can be at the end of a really hard time. And sometimes the reward that you get so quickly, that should make you nervous. Makes me nervous. There's a competition between habits too. Whenever we're picking up a new habit, there might be an old way of thinking, an old system. I don't know if you remember the RC cars in the snow, you know? Every time we walk a path in the snow, we cut out a new path, and it's a lot easier to walk where somebody else has walked in the snow than to carve our own path again. It's easier to walk in somebody else's footsteps than it is to carve your own. So often when we're trying to mindfully choose a better habit, there's something else that we've set up in the past that is standing in the way. And this makes it more difficult to make that new choice and that new decision. So be mindful of your habits and know what's standing in the way between you and your own idea of success and your own health. You know. Anyways, I got a couple readings I want to do real quick. So starting out first, I want to do, it's from this horrible parenting book. So this is from Pinocchio Parenting, which I don't even know this tool. It looks like he was on TV. Host of TV's at Home. Yeah, fuck you. I really didn't appreciate this book, but there was some good stuff in it. And even if I dislike a book, I'm still going to read it all. Ugh. All 272 pages. All 272 pages of this book. I read it all, even though I don't like it. So you got to stay persistent and look for diamonds in the garbage. So one of the things that I did really like about this one is this, it's a story about a boy named Ordinary. And here it goes. Not long ago, and not far away, a nobody named Ordinary lived in the land of the familiar. Every day was pretty much the same for Ordinary. Get up, work, eat, watch TV, go to bed, repeat. Ordinary thought that he was content. His routines were reliable, his worries were minimal, his life was comfortable. Then one day, Ordinary noticed a small nagging feeling inside that seemed to tell him something big was missing in his life. The feeling, one that few in the land of the familiar ever experienced, grew. Sometime later, Ordinary heard these words. What you're missing, you already have. Ordinary looked and looked for the source of the statement. Finally, he discovered that in the corner of his heart lay a big dream. The big dream told him that he, a nobody, was made to be a somebody and to achieve great things. The big dream had come to Ordinary from someone known as the Dream Giver. While Ordinary had heard rumors of the Dream Giver and of big dreams coming to others, he had never imagined that such a thing would happen to him. At first, Ordinary kept his big dream to himself, fearing he would become the town fool if he shared it. Eventually, though, he told his dream to his best friend, who predictably suggested that Ordinary keep quiet about it. Big dreams weren't a part of life in the land of the familiar. Discontent grew within Ordinary, and so did his desire to share his big dream. Finally, in despair, he told his big dream to his father. I'm not surprised, his father responded. You've had that dream since you were little. Tears filled Ordinary's eyes. I was born to fulfill this dream, he realized. Then, Ordinary's father told him about his own tragic experience. He, too, had been given a big dream by the Dream Giver a long, long time ago. He had waited for the right time and the right circumstance to pursue his dream, but the timing was never right and the circumstances never changed. Soon it was too late and his dream turned to dust. He had missed his destiny. Don't make the same mistake I did, son, he told Ordinary. You don't have to be a nobody. You can be a somebody. From that moment on, Ordinary decided not to repeat his father's mistakes. Over time, he made hard choices and difficult changes. Despite pleas from his best friend to stay in the land of the familiar, Ordinary left to the land of possibility, humming a tune he'd never heard before. He soon discovered that there were bullies to battle in the land of possibility, discouragement, pessimism, and doubt. But they did not deter him. He never returned to his old home, ever. He knew he was born to do more than the ordinary, the comfortable, and the familiar. He was made for a mission. So I like that one. And I'm not even going to ruin it with my own interpretation. I think it's pretty obvious, you know, but just consider it, you know. We all have immense possibility and promise within us. And all it takes is a little bit of persistence through trial and error sometimes. So I recently started a new Taoist text. It's a collection by Thomas Merton. So it's called The Way of Chuangzu. And Chuangzu is another very, very important Taoist teacher. He did a lot of, most of the people think that he lived between, I think, 300 and 400 BC or 400 and 500 BC, between that 200 year period, somewhere in there. I know I'm awful at having specifics, but the man did most of his teachings then, which is very close to the time period of Lao Tzu. And there's some dispute over whether he was a person, but there's a lot more evidence to push towards the fact that Chuang Tzu was actually a person. Because it's just, it gets so murky with some of these old stories. And he is really, really obscure. I have to read his stuff over and over and over and over and over again to try to get a read on it. So this one is the first one. It's called The Useless Tree. Hu Tzu said to Chuang, "I have a big tree, the kind they call a stink tree. The trunk is so distorted, so full of knots, no one can get a straight plank out of it. The branches are so crooked, you cannot cut them up in any way that makes sense. There it stands beside the road. No carpenter will even look at it. Such is your teaching, big and useless." Chuang Tzu replied, "Have you ever watched the wildcat crouching, watching his prey? This way it leaps, and that way, high and low, and at last lands in the trap. But have you ever seen the yak, great as a thundercloud? He stands in his might. Big? Sure. He can't catch mice. So for your big tree, no use? Then plant it in the wasteland, in emptiness. Walk idly around, rest under its shadow. No axe or bill prepares its end. No one will ever cut it down. Useless, you should worry." So, I didn't get it at first, and I waited a whole day, and then I read it again. And basically, this idea of Tao, which is the unspeakable Tao, you know, everything in reality is within Tao. And it's so that's what he means. It's like, it's so vague and it's so obscure, which makes it hard to talk about. And so this is the bigness, because it encompasses everything. It's too big. It's too general for Hui Tzu. But so this is why he describes it as this big gangly tree, because nobody can describe it. Nobody can pin it down. Nobody can really teach Tao. It encompasses everything. You can't turn it into anything. It's not practical. It's an ugly tree. It's a useless tree. So Chuang starts out by saying the cat is small in stature, can hop around and catch whatever it needs. The yak is huge in stature, but it can't catch anything, which confused me. And then he says that if you have a useless tree, plant it in the middle of nowhere, because then at least you can look at it, or you can get shade from it. It'll have use even there. But because it's impractical to the people who are looking for practicality, nobody's ever going to try to cut it down. So by not having a value based in society's value system makes you impractical, but it also makes you safe because you have your own solidarity in your own system. Maybe. I'm going to have to read it about another 100 times before I have any idea. But anyways, I'm going to do a little bit more Chuang Tzu throughout time, and we'll do more of it. And right before I pass the baton, I'm going to do a little bit of Tao. This is again from Ursula K. Le Guin's Tao. This is Lao Tzu, the Tao Te Ching. Mindful of little things. It's easy to keep hold of what hasn't stirred, easy to plan what hasn't occurred. It's easy to shatter delicate things, easy to scatter little things. Do things before they happen, get them straight before they get mixed up. The tree you can't reach your arms around grew from a tiny seedling. The 90-story tower rises from a heap of clay. The 10,000-mile journey begins beneath your one single foot. Do and do wrong, hold on and lose. Not doing, the wise soul doesn't do it wrong, and not holding on doesn't lose it. In all their undertakings, it's just as they're almost finished that people go wrong. Mind the end as the beginning, then it won't go wrong. That's why the wise want not to want, care nothing for hard-won treasures. Learn not to be learned. Turn back to what people overlooked. They go along with things as they are, but don't presume to act. So that one's dense. and it's full of a lot of things, but I think it has relationship to what verse I just read from Chuang, which is, we humans destroy ourselves often by getting in our own way. And to tie it into the episode, often by getting in our own way, we overthink decisions or miscalculate them. We underthink or overthink our decisions. And often this miscalculation of just not being aware of what's going on is how we ruin ourselves and how we turn it into worse situations than they needed to be. At least I do that. I don't know if you do. I can't speak for you, but I do. All right. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. I am so grateful for this opportunity to have your ear right now. And if you're here at the end of this episode, about to hear my son speak, which is one of my favorite parts about this, you know, I just want you to know how special you are to me, how special you are to this world, and that there are people in your life that think you are as special as I do, perhaps more, because they actually get to interact with you. So keep that specialness, make it thrive, and grow with it. Here we go on to O. Ask O. Hi, O.
Hi.
How you doing, dude?
Good.
How's your day?
Good.
How's your week?
Good.
Good, 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 good?
Yep.
How about pineapples?
Yes.
You like pineapples?
Yes.
What about turnips?
What's turnips?
Can you not kick this?
What's turnips?
A turnip is a type of food.
No. I like turnips.
You don't like turnips? No. All right. Are you ready for my question for you today?
Yes.
How do you choose what to do?
I don't know.
Tell me. How do you make a decision?
I don't know.
Okay. If I have two things, which one do you choose? This hand or this hand? Why?
I don't know.
You don't know at all?
No.
Have you ever thought about it?
No.
Well, if I had a banana and a bowl of ice cream, which one would you want?
Well, I want ice cream.
Why?
Because I like ice cream.
More than the banana?
No.
You like ice cream more than the banana?
No.
Then why do you want ice cream?
Because I like ice cream.
Okay. So do you think you make choices because of what you like?
No.
Not at all?
Yes.
Okay. Well, tell me more about that.
I don't know.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate your time. You want to say bye?
Bye.
You want to say bye to your friends?
Bye-bye, friends.
Have a good week.